Side 2, The Hidden City, The Tomilly, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 37. Forgive me, Goddess Afriel, the Emperor apologized. I seldom have divine visitors. He looked at her rather closely. I hope you don't mind my saying so, but you rather resemble Prince Sparhawk's daughter. Have you ever met her, Royal Highness? Sparhawk's head came up sharply, and there was a strange, almost wild look in his eyes. Now that you mention it, I don't think I have, Flute said. She looked across the room at the princess. Barret noticed that Sophrenia's eyes were also just a bit wild as Flute slid down out of her lap and went across the room to Sparhawk's chair. Hello, Danae, the child goddess said in an offhand sort of way. Hello, Afriel, the princess replied in almost exactly the same tone. Are you going to do something to get my mother back home? I'm working on it. Try to keep your father from getting too excited about this. He's no good to any of us when he flies all to pieces and we have to gather him up and put him back together again. I know. I'll do what I can with him. Would you like to hold my cat? Flute glanced at Myrrh, whose eyes were filled with a look of absolute horror. I don't think she likes me, she declined. I'll take care of my father, Danae assured the little goddess. You deal with these others. All right, Afriel paused. I think we'll get on well together, she said. You wouldn't mind if I stopped by from time to time, would you? Any time, Afriel. Something very peculiar was going on. Barret saw nothing unusual in the conversation between the two little girls, but Sparhawk's face and Sophrenia's clearly showed that they were both very disturbed. Barret kept his expression casual and looked around. Everyone else had faintly indulgent smiles on their faces as they watched the exchange, all except Lord Vanyan and Anaray Zanisha. Their faces were no less strained than Sparhawk's and Sophrenia's. Evidently, something titanic had just happened, but for the life of him, Barret could not fathom out what it might have been.
I don't think we should discount the possibility, Oscania said gravely. Baroness Melodir has demonstrated again and again the fact that she has a very penetrating mind.
Thank you, Your Excellency, Melodir said sweetly.
I wasn't really being complimentary, Baroness, he replied coolly. Your intelligence is a resource to be exploited in this situation. You've seen Scarpa, and we haven't. Do you really believe he's mad?
Yes, Your Excellency, quite mad. It wasn't only his behavior that convinced me of it. Krager and the others treated him the way you treat a live cobra. They're terrified of him. That dovetails rather neatly with some of the reports I got from the thieves of Arjuna, Kaalador agreed. There's always a certain amount of exaggeration involved when people talk about madmen, but every report that came in mentioned it.
If you're trying to make Sparhawk and me feel better, you're going at it in a strange way, Kaalador, Colton accused. You're suggesting that the women we love are the prisoners of a crazy man. He could do anything.
It might not be as bad as it looks, Sir Colton, Oscania said. If Scarpa's mad, couldn't this abduction have been his idea alone? If that's the case, our solution becomes almost too simple. Prince Sparhawk simply follows the instructions he receives to the letter, and when Scarpa appears with Queen Elana and Aileen, His Highness simply hands over the bellium. We all know what'll happen to Scarpa as soon as he touches it.
You're equating insanity with feeble-mindedness, Oscania, Sarabian disagreed, and that's simply not the way it works. Zelasta knows that the rings would protect him if he ever managed to get his hands on bellium, and if he knows, then we have to assume that Scarpa does too. He'll demand the rings before he even tries to touch the jewel.
We have three possibilities, then, Patriarch Amban summed up. Either Sirgon instructed Zelasta to arrange for the abduction, or Zelasta came up with a notion on his own, or Scarpa's so crazy that he thinks he can just pick up bellium and start giving it commands with no instruction or preparation at all.
There's one more possibility, Your Grace, Ulath said. Clell could already be in charge, and this could be his way to force bellium to come to him for their customary contest.
What difference does it make at this point? Sparhawk asked. Suddenly, we won't know whose idea it is until we see who shows up to make the exchange.
We should have some plans in place, Prince Sparhawk, Oscania pointed out. We should try to think our way through each situation so that we'll know what to do.
I already know what I'm going to do, Your Excellency, Sparhawk told him bleakly.
At the moment, we can't do anything, Vanyan said, moving in rather quickly. All we can do is wait for Krager's next note.
Truly,
Ulof agreed.
Krager's going to give Sparhawk instructions. Those instructions might give us some clues about whose idea this really is.
You noticed it too, didn't you? Barrett said to Khalad that evening when the two of them were getting ready for bed.
Noticed what?
Don't play the innocent with me, Khalad. You see everything that's going on around you. Nothing gets by you. Sparhawk and Sophronia were behaving very peculiarly when Flute and Danae were talking to each other.
Yes,
Khalad admitted calmly.
So what?
Aren't you curious about why?
Has it occurred to you that why might not be any of our business?
Barrett stepped around that. Did you notice how much the two little girls resemble each other? Khalad shrugged.
You're the expert on girls.
Barrett suddenly blushed and silently cursed himself for blushing.
It isn't a secret, you know,
Khalad told him.
Empress Elisun's fairly obvious. She doesn't hide her feelings any more than she hides... well, you know.
She's a good girl, Barrett quickly came to her defense. It's just that her people don't pay any attention to our kind of morality. They can't even comprehend the notion of fidelity.
I'm not throwing rocks at her. If the way she behaves doesn't bother her husband, it certainly doesn't bother me. I'm a country boy, remember? We're more realistic about things like that. I just wouldn't get too attached to her, Barrett. Her attention may wander in time.
It already has, Barrett replied. She doesn't want to discontinue our friendship, though. She wants to be friendly to me and to him, and to the half-dozen or so others she neglected to mention earlier.
The world needs more friendliness, Barrett.
Khalad grinned.
There wouldn't be so many wars if people were friendlier.
Krager's next note arrived 2 days later, and it was authenticated by another lock of Aelana's hair. The thought of the sodden drunkard violating his queen's pale blonde hair enraged Barrett for some obscure reason. Vanyan once again read the note to them, while Sparhawk sat somewhat apart, gently holding the lock of his wife's hair in his fingers.
"Sparhawk, old boy," the note began. "You don't mind if I call you that, do you? I always admired the way Martell sort of tossed that off when everything was going his way. It was pretty much the only thing about him that I admired. Enough of these fond reminiscences. You're going to be making a trip, Sparhawk. We want you to take your squire and travel by the customary overland route to Beressa in southeastern Arjuna. You'll be watched, so don't take any side trips. Don't have Colton and the other baboons trailing along behind you. Don't have Sophronia disguised as a mouse or a flea hidden in your pocket. And most definitely, don't use Bellium for anything at all. Not even for building campfires. I know we can depend on your absolute cooperation, old boy, since you'll never see Aelana alive again if you misbehave. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Sparhawk, particularly in view of the fact that it's your hands that are chained this time. Now stop wasting time. Take Khalad and the Bellium and go to Beressa. You'll receive further instructions there. Fondly, Krager.
Chapter 3 They talked and talked and talked, and every maybe or possibly or probably or, on the other hand, set Sparhawk's teeth on edge. It was all pure speculation, useless guessing that circled and circled and never got to the point. He sat slightly apart from them, holding the lock of pale hair. The hair felt strangely alive, coiling around his fingers in a soft caress. It was his fault, of course. He should never have permitted Aelana to come to Tamale. It went further than that, though. Aelana had been in danger all her life, and it had all been because of him. Because of the fact that he was Annika. Zanisha had said that Annika was invincible, but she was wrong. Annika was as vulnerable as any married man. By marrying Aelana, he had immediately put her at risk, a risk that would last for as long as she lived. He should never have married her. He loved her, of course, but was it an act of love to put her in danger?
he silently cursed the weakness that had led him even to consider the ridiculous notion when she had first raised it. He was a soldier, and soldiers should never marry, particularly not scarred, battered old veterans with too many years and too many battles behind them and too many enemies still about. Was he some selfish old fool, some disgusting, half-senile lecher, eager to take advantage of a foolish young girl's infatuation? Elana had extravagantly declared that she would die if he refused her. But he knew better than that. People die from a sword in the belly or from old age, but they do not die from love. He should have laughed in her face and rejected her absurd command. Then he could have arranged a proper marriage for her, a marriage to some handsome young nobleman with good manners and a safe occupation. If he had, she would still be safely back in Samura, instead of in the hands of madmen, degenerate sorcerers, and alien gods to whom her life meant nothing at all. And still they talked on and on. Why were they wasting all their breath? There wasn't any choice in the matter. Sparhawk would obey the instructions because Elana's life depended on it. The others were certain to argue with him about it, and the arguments would only irritate him. The best thing would probably be just to take the Bellium and Khalad and slip out of Matherion without giving them the chance to drive him mad with their meaningless babble. It was the touch of a spring-like breeze on his cheek and a soft nuzzling on his hand that roused him from his gloomy reverie.
"It was not mine intent to disturb thy thoughts, Sir Knight,"
the white deer apologized,
"but my mistress would have words with thee."
Sparhawk jerked his head around in astonishment. He no longer sat in the blue-draped room in Matherion, and the voices of the others had faded away to be replaced by the sound of the gentle lapping of waves upon a golden strand. His chair now sat on the marble floor of Afriel's temple on the small, verdant island that rose gem-like from the sea. The breeze was soft under the rainbow-colored sky, and the ancient oaks around the alabaster temple rustled softly.
"Thou hast forgotten me,"
the gentle white hind reproached him, her liquid eyes touched with sorrow.
"Never," he replied. "I shall remember thee always, dear creature, for I do love thee, even as I did when first we met."
The extravagant expression came to his lips unbidden. The white deer sighed happily and laid her snowy head in his lap. He stroked her arched white neck and looked around. The child goddess Afriel, gowned in white and surrounded by a glowing nimbus, sat calmly on a branch of one of the nearby oaks. She lifted her many-chambered pipes and blew an almost mocking little trill.
"What are you up to now, Afriel?"
he called up to her, deliberately forcing away the flowery words that jumped to his lips.
"I thought you might want to talk," she replied, lowering the pipes. "Did you want some more time for self-mortification? Would you like a whip so that you can flog yourself with it? Take as much time as you want, Father. This particular instant will last for as long as I want it to."
She reached out with one grass-stained little foot, placed it on nothing at all, and calmly walked down a non-existent stairway to the alabaster floor of her temple. She sank down on it, crossed her feet at the ankles, and lifted her pipes again.
"Will it disturb your sour musings if I play?"
"Just what do you think you're doing?" he demanded.
She shrugged.
"You seem to have this obscure need for penance of some kind, and there's no time for it. I wouldn't be much of a goddess if I couldn't satisfy both needs at the same time. Now would I?"
She raised her pipes.
"Do you have any favorites you'd like to hear?"
"You're actually serious, aren't you?"
"Yes."
He breathed another little trill into the pipes. He glared at her for a moment, and then he gave up.
"Can we talk about this?" he asked her.
"You've come to your senses? Already? Amazing."
He looked around at the island.
"Where is this place?" he asked curiously.
The child got his shrugged.
"Wherever I want it to be. I carry it with me every place I go. Were you serious about what you were just thinking, Sparhawk? Were you really going to snatch up Bellium, grab Khalad by the scruff of the neck, leap onto Farron's back, and try to ride off in three directions at the same time?"
"All Vanyan and the others are doing is talking, Afriel, and the talk isn't going anywhere."
"Did you speak with Bellium about this notion of yours?"
"The decision is mine, Afriel. Elana's my wife."
"How brave you are, Sparhawk. You're making a decision that involves the Bellium without even consulting it. Don't be misled by its seeming politeness, Father. That's just a reflection of its archaic speech. It won't do something it knows is wrong, no matter how sorry you're feeling for yourself. And if you grow too insistent, it might just decide to create a new son, about 6 inches from your heart.
I have the rings, Aphriel. I'm still the one giving the orders. She laughed at him.
Do you really think the rings mean anything, Sparhawk? They have no control over Bellium at all. That was just a subterfuge that concealed the fact that it has an awareness and a will and purpose of its own. It can ignore the rings any time it wants to.
Then why did it need me?
Because you're a necessity, Sparhawk, like wind or tide or rain. You're as necessary as Clell is, or Bellium, or me, for that matter. Someday we'll have to come back here and have a long talk about necessity, but we're a little pressed for time right now.
And was that little virtuoso performance of yours yesterday another necessity as well? Would the world have come to an end if you hadn't held that public conversation with yourself?
What I did yesterday was useful, Father, not necessary. I am who I am, and I can't change that. When I'm going through one of these transitions, there are usually people around who know both of the little girls, and they start noticing the similarities. I always make it a point to have the girls meet each other in public. It puts off tiresome questions and lays unwanted suspicions to rest.
You terrified Myrrh, you know. She nodded.
I'll make it up to her. That's always been a problem. Animals can see right through my disguises. They don't look at us in the way that we look at each other. He sighed.
What am I going to do, Aphriel?
I was hoping that a visit here would bring you back to your senses. A stopover in reality usually has that effect.
He looked up at her private, rainbow-colored sky.
This is your notion of reality?
Don't you like my reality?
It's lovely, he told her, absently stroking the white deer's neck. But it's a dream.
Are you really sure about that, Sparhawk? Are you so certain that this isn't reality, and that other place isn't a dream?
Don't do that. It makes my head hurt. What should I do?
I'd say that your first step ought to be to have a long conversation with Bellium. All of your moping around and contemplating arbitrary decisions has it more than a little worried.
All right. Then what?
I haven't gotten that far yet. She grinned at him. I'm a-working on it, though, Dorlin, she added.
They're going to be all right, Carlton, Sparhawk said, gently laying his hand on his suffering friend's shoulder.
Carlton looked up, his eyes filled with hopeless misery.
Are you sure, Sparhawk? They will be if we can just keep our heads. Aelana was in much more danger when I came back from Rendor, and we took care of that, didn't we? I suppose you're right.
Carlton straightened up in his chair and jerked down his blue doublet. His face was bleak.
I think I'm going to find some people and hurt them, he declared.
Would you mind if I came along?
You can help if you like.
Carlton rubbed at the side of his face.
I've been thinking, he said. You know that if you follow those orders in Krager's note, he'll be able to keep you plodding from one end of Tomalley to the other for the next year or more, don't you?
Do I have any choice? They're going to be watching me.
Let them. Do you remember how we met Barret?
He was a novice in the chapter house in Samura.
Sparhawk shrugged.
Not when I first saw him, he wasn't. I was coming back from exile in Lamorkand, and I stopped at a roadside tavern outside of Samura. Barret was there with Kirik, and he was wearing your armor. I've known you since we were children, and even I couldn't tell that he wasn't you. If I couldn't tell, Krager's spies certainly won't be able to. If somebody has to plot around Tomalley, let Barret do it. You and I have better things to do.
Sparhawk was startled.
That's the best idea I've heard yet.
He looked around at the others.
Could I have your attention, please? He said.
They all looked sharply at him, their faces apprehensive.
It's time to get to work, he told them. Carlton here just reminded me that we've used Sir Barret as a decoy in the past. Barret and I are nearly the same size, and my armor fits him, more or less, and with his visor down, nobody can really tell that he isn't me.
If we can prevail on him to masquerade as a broken-down old campaigner again, we might just be able to prepare a few surprises for Krager and his friends.
You don't even have to ask, Sparhawk, Barrett said.
Get some details before you volunteer like that, Barrett, Collard told his friend in a pained voice.
Your father used to say almost exactly the same thing, Barrett recalled.
Why didn't you listen to him?
It's an interesting plan, Prince Sparhawk, Lascagna said, a bit dubiously. But isn't it extremely dangerous? I'm not afraid, Your Excellency, Barrett protested. I wasn't talking about your danger, young sir. I'm talking about the danger to Queen Elana. The moment someone penetrates your disguise, well, Oscania spread his hands. Then we'll just have to make sure that his disguise is foolproof, Sophronia said.
He can't keep his visor down forever, Sophronia, Sarabian objected.
I don't think he'll have to, Sophronia replied. She looked speculatively at Zanisha. Do we trust each other enough to cooperate, Anare? She asked. I'm talking about something a little deeper than we've gone so far.
I will listen most attentively to thy proposal, my sister.
Delphaic magic is directed primarily inward, isn't it?
Zanisha nodded.
That's probably why no one can hear or feel it. Spheric magic is just the reverse. We alter things around us, so our magic reaches out. Neither form will work by itself in this particular situation. But if we were to combine them...
She left it hanging in the air between them.
Interesting notion, Afriel mused. I'm not sure I follow, Vanyan said.
The Anare and I are going to have to experiment a bit, Sophronia told him. But if what I've got in mind works, we'll be able to make Barrett look so much like Sparhawk that they'll be able to use each other for shaving mirrors. As long as each of us knows exactly what the other's doing, it's not too difficult, Sparhawk, Sophronia assured him later when he and Barrett joined her, Vanyan, and the Anare in the room she shared with Vanyan.
Will it really work? He asked her dubiously.
They haven't actually tried it yet, Sparhawk, Vanyan told him, so we're not entirely positive.
That doesn't sound too promising. This isn't much of a face, but it's the only one I've got.
There will be no danger to thee or to young Sir Barrett, Annika, Zanisha said. In times past, it hath oft been necessary for my people to leave our valley and to go abroad amongst others. This hath been our means of disguising our true identity.
It works sort of like this, Sparhawk, Sophronia explained. Zanisha casts a Delphaic spell that would normally imprint your features on her own face. But just as she releases her spell, I release a Styric one that deflects the spell to Barrett instead.
Won't every Styric and Matherian feel it when you release your spell? Sparhawk asked.
That's the beauty of it, Sparhawk, Afriel told him. The spell itself originates with Zanisha, and others can't feel or hear a Delphaic spell. Sirgon himself could be in the next room, and he wouldn't hear a thing.
You're sure it's going to work?
There's one way to find out.
Sparhawk, of course, did not feel a thing. He was only the model, after all. It was a bit disconcerting to watch Barrett's appearance gradually change, however. When the combined spell had been completed, Sparhawk carefully inspected his young friend.
Do I really look like that from the side? He asked Vanyan, feeling a bit deflated.
I can't tell the two of you apart.
That nose is really crooked, isn't it?
We thought you knew.
I've never looked at myself from the side this way before.
Sparhawk looked critically at Barrett's eyes.
You should probably try to squint just a little, he suggested. My eyes aren't as good as they used to be. That's one of the things you have to look forward to as you get older.
I'll try to remember that. Even Barrett's voice was different.
Do I really sound like that?
Sparhawk was crestfallen.
Vanyan nodded.
Sparhawk shook his head. Seeing and hearing yourself as others do definitely lowers your opinion of yourself, he admitted.
He looked at Barrett again.
I didn't feel anything, did you?
Barrett nodded, swallowing hard.
What was it like?
I'd really rather not talk about it. Barrett gently explored his new face with cringing fingertips, wincing as he did.
I still can't tell them apart, Colton marveled, staring first at Barrett and then at Sparhawk.
That was sort of the idea, Sparhawk told him.
Which one are you?
Try to be serious, Colton.
Now that we know how it's done, we can make some other changes as well, Sophrenia told them. We'll give you all different faces so that you'll be able to move around freely. And we'll put men wearing your faces here in the palace. I think we can all expect to be watched, even after the Harvest Festival, and this should nullify that particular problem.
We can make more detailed plans later, Vanyan said. Let's get Barrett and Khalad on their way first. What's the customary route when someone wants to go overland from here to Baressa?
He unrolled a map and spread it out on the table.
Most travelers go by sea, Oscania replied, but those who don't usually cross the peninsula to Mycy, and then take a ship across the gulf to the mainland.
There don't seem to be any roads over there.
Vanyan frowned, looking at the map.
It's a relatively uninhabited region, Lord Vanyan.
Oscania shrugged.
Salt marshes and the like. What few tracks there are wouldn't show up on the map.
Do the best you can, Vanyan told the two young men. Once you get past the Tommel Mountains, you'll hit that road that skirts the western side of the jungle.
I'd make a special point of staying out of those mountains, Barrett, Ulof advised. There are trolls there now.
Barrett nodded.
You'd better have a talk with Farron, Sparhawk, Khalad suggested. I don't think he'll be fooled just because Barrett's wearing your face. And Barrett's going to have to ride him if this is going to be convincing.
I'd forgotten that, Sparhawk admitted.
I thought you might have. All right, then.
Vanyan continued his instructions to the two young men.
Follow that road down to Lidros. Then take the road around the southern tip of Arjuna to Baressa. That's the logical route. And they'll probably be expecting you to go that way.
That's going to take quite a while, Lord Vanyan, Khalad said.
I know. Evidently, Krager and his friends wanted to. If they were in a hurry, they'd have instructed Sparhawk to go by sea.
Give Barrett your wife's ring, Sparhawk, Clute instructed.
What?
Zelasta can sense the ring, and if he can, Sirgon can too, and Clell will definitely feel it. If you don't give Barrett the ring, changing his face was just a waste of time. You're putting Barrett and Khalad in a great deal of danger, Sophrenia said critically.
That's what we get paid for, little mother.
Khalad shrugged.
I'll watch over them, Afriel assured her sister. She looked critically at Barrett. Call me, she told him.
Ma'am?
Use the spell, Barrett, she explained with exaggerated patience. I want to be sure you're doing it right.
Oh. Barrett carefully enunciated the spell of summoning, his hands moving in the intricate accompanying gestures.
You mispronounced Kajarastakan, she corrected him.
Sophrenia was trying without much success to suppress a laugh.
What's so funny? Talon asked her.
Sir Barrett's pronunciations raised some questions about his meaning, Stragan explained.
What did he say?
Talon asked. Curiously.
Just never mind what he said, Flute told him primly. We're not here to repeat off-color jokes about the differences between boys and girls. Practice on that one, Barrett. Now try the secret summoning.
What's that? Itanya murmured to Vanyan.
It's used to pass messages, Your Excellency, Vanyan replied. It summons the awareness of the child goddess, but not her presence. We can give her a message to carry to someone else by using that spell.
Isn't that just a little demeaning for the child goddess? Do you really make her run errands and carry messages that way? I'm not offended, Itanya, Afriel smiled. After all, we live only to serve those we love, don't we?
Barrett's pronunciation of the second spell raised no objections.
You'll probably want to use that one most of the time anyway, Barrett, Vanyan instructed. Krager warned Sparhawk about using magic. So don't be too obvious about things. If you get any further instructions along the road, make some show of following them.
but pass the word on to Afriel.
There's no real point in decking him out in Sparhawk's armor now, is there, Lord Vanyan?
Khalad asked.
Good point,
Vanyan agreed.
A mail shirt should do, Barrett. We want them to see your face now.
Yes, my lord.
Now you better get some sleep,
Vanyan continued.
You'll be starting early tomorrow morning.
Not too early, though, Cahalador amended. We surely wouldn't want the spies to oversleep theirselves and miss seeing you leave. Getting a new face don't mean shucks if you don't get no chance to show it off now, does it? It was chill and damp in the courtyard the following morning, and a thin autumn mist lay over the gleaming city. Sparhawk led Farron out of the stables. Just be careful, he cautioned the two young men in chainmail shirts and traveler's cloaks.
You've said that already, my lord, Khalad reminded him. Barrett and I aren't deaf, you know.
You'd better forget that name, Khalad, Sparhawk said critically. Start thinking of your young friend here as me. A slip of the tongue in the wrong place could give this all away.
I'll keep that in mind.
Do you need money?
I thought you'd never ask.
You're as bad as your father was.
Sparhawk pulled a purse from under his belt and handed it to his squire. Then he firmly took Farron by the chin and looked straight into the big roan's eyes.
I want you to go with Barrett, Farron, he said. Behave exactly as you would if he were me.
Farron flicked his ears and looked away.
Pay attention, Sparhawk said sharply. This is important.
Farron sighed.
He knows what you're talking about, Sparhawk, Khalad said. He's not stupid, just bad-tempered.
Sparhawk handed the reins to Barrett. Then he remembered something.
We'll need a password, he said. The rest of us are going to have different faces, so you won't recognize us if we have to contact you. Pick something ordinary.
They all considered it. How about ram's horn? Barrett suggested. It shouldn't be too hard to work it into an ordinary conversation, and we've used it before. Sparhawk suddenly remembered Ulysim, most favored disciple of Holy Erisham, standing atop a pile of rubble with Kirik's crossbow bolt sticking out of his forehead and the word ram's horn still on his lips.
Very good, Barrett. Sir Sparhawk, that is. It's a word we all remember. You'd better get started.
They nodded and swung up into their saddles.
Good luck, Sparhawk said.
You too, my lord,
Khalad replied. And then the pair turned and rode slowly toward the drawbridge. All we've really got to work with is the name Baressa, Sarabian mused somewhat later. Krieger's note said that Sparhawk would receive further instructions there.
That could be a ruse, Your Majesty, Itanya pointed out. Actually, the exchange could take place at any time, and any place. That might have been the reason for the instructions to go overland.
That's true, Kalador agreed. Scarpa and Zelasta might just be waiting on the beach on the west side of the Gulf of Mycie, waiting to make the trade right there, for all we know.
We're going to an awful lot of trouble here, Talon said. Why doesn't Sparhawk just have Belium go rescue the queen? It could pick her up and have her back here before Scarpa even knew she was gone.
No, Afriel said, shaking her head. Belium can't do that any more than I can.
Why not?
Because we don't know where she is. And we can't go looking for her, because they'll be able to sense us moving around.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Afriel rolled her eyes upward.
Men!
She sighed. It was very resourceful of Elana to slip her ring to Melodir, Sophronia said. But locating her would be much easier if she still had it with her.
I sort of doubt that, dear, Vanyan disagreed. Zelasta, of all people, knows that the rings can be traced. If Elana had still been wearing it, the first thing Scarpa would have done would have been to send Krager or Elrond off in the opposite direction with it.
You're assuming that Zelasta's involved in this, she disagreed. There is the possibility that Scarpa's acting on his own, you know.
It's always better to assume the worst, he shrugged. Our situation is much more perilous if Zelasta and Sirgon are involved. If it's only Scarpa, he'll be relatively easy to dispose of.
But only after Elana and Aileen are safe, Sparhawk amended.
That goes without saying, Sparhawk, Vanyan said.
Everything hinges on the moment of the exchange, then, doesn't it? Sarabian noted. We can make some preparations, but we won't be able to do anything at all significant until the moment that Scarpa actually produces Aelana.
And that means that we have to stay close to Barret and Khalad, Tinian added.
No, Afriel was shaking her head. You'll give everything away if you all start hovering over those two. Let me do the staying close. I don't wear armor, so no one will be able to smell me from 1,000 paces off. Itania's right. The exchange could come at any time. I'll let Sparhawk know the very instant Scarpa shows up with Aelana and Aileen. Then Bellium can set him down, with knife, right on top of them. We'll have the ladies back, and we'll be more or less in charge of things again.
And that brings us right back to a purely military situation, Patriarch Emban mused. I think we'll want to send word to Comier and Bergston. We're going to need the church knights in Seneska and Arjuna, not in Edom or Estelle, or here in Methurian. Let's have them ride southeast after they come down out of the mountains of Zemok. We'll have the Aetons in Sarna, the Eastern Paloi, and the church knights we've already got in Samar, the trolls in the Tommel Mountains, and Comier and Bergston on the western side of the desert of Seneska. We'll be able to squeeze the land out of the Sirgai like a lemon at that point.
And see what kind of seeds come popping out, Kalton added bleakly.
Patriarch Emban, first secretary of the Church of Kyrellos, was a man who absolutely adored lists. The fat little churchman automatically drew up a list when any subject was being discussed. There is a certain point in most discussions when things have all been settled and the participants start going back over the various points. Inevitably, that was the point at which Emban pulled out his list.
All right, then, he said, in a tone that clearly said that he was summing up. Sparhawk will take ship for Beressa, along with Milord Stragan and young Master Talon, right?
It puts him in place in case Barret and Khalad do, in fact, have to ride all the way down there, Your Grace, Vanyan said. And Stragan and Talon have contacts in Beressa, so they'll probably be able to find out just who else is in town.
Emban checked that off his list. Next, Sir Colton, Sir Bevier, and Master Calador will sail south on a different ship and go into the jungles of Arjuna.
Calador nodded. I've got a friend in the Dilo who has contacts with the robber bands in those jungles, he said. We'll join one of those bands, so we'll be able to keep an eye on the tiles and pass the word if Scarpa's army starts to move.
Right, Emban checked that off. Next, Sir Ulaf and Sir Tinian will go to the Tommel Mountains to stay in touch with the trolls. He frowned. Why is Tinian going there? He asked. He doesn't speak trollish.
Tinian and I get along well, Ulaf rumbled. And I'll get terribly lonely if there's no one around to talk with but trolls. You have no idea how depressing it is to be alone with trolls, Your Grace.
Whatever makes you happy, Sir Ulaf, Emban shrugged. Now then, Sophrenia and Anarae Zanisha will go to Delphaeus to advise Anarae Sedan about all these recent developments and to explain what we're doing, and to see what we can do to make peace between Styracum and the Delphae. Sophrenia added.
Emban checked off another item. He said, Lord Vanyan, Queen Betwana, Ambassador Itania, and Domi Kring will take the 5,000 knights and go to Western Tommel proper to join with the forces they have in place in Sarna and Samar.
Where is Domi Kring? Betwana asked, looking around for the little man.
He's standing guard over Mirtai, Princess Danae said. He's still about half afraid she might try to kill herself.
We might have a problem there, Bevier observed. Under those circumstances, Kring might not be willing to leave Methurian.
We can get along without him if we have to, Vanyan said. I can deal with Takumi directly. Having Kring around would make it easier, but I can make do without him if he really thinks that Mirtai might do something foolish.
Emban nodded. Emperor Sarabian, Foreign Minister Oscania, and I we'll stay here in Methurian and hold down the fort, and the child goddess will keep us all in touch with each other. Have I left anything out?
What do you want me to do, Emban?
Danae asked sweetly. You'll stay here in Methurian with us, Your Royal Highness, Emban replied, to
to brighten our gloomy days and nights with the sunshine of your smile.
Are you making fun of me, Your Grace?
Of course not, Princess.
To say that Mirtai was unhappy would have been the grossest of understatements. She was in chains when Kring brought her into the council chamber with a hopeless look on his face.
Nothing I say reaches her, the Domi told them. I think she's even forgotten that we're betrothed.
The golden Aton giantess would not look at any of them, but sank instead to the floor in abject misery.
She has failed her owner,
Betwana shrugged.
She must either avenge her or die.
Not quite, Your Majesty,
Sparhawk's daughter said firmly. She slipped down from the chair in the corner from which she had been watching the proceedings. She deposited Rollo in one corner of the chair and Myrrh in the other, and crossed the room to Mirtai with a businesslike look on her small face.
Aitana Mirtai, she said crisply, get up off the floor.
Mirtai looked sullenly at her, then slowly rose, her chains clinking.
In my mother's absence, I am the queen, Danae declared.
Sparhawk blinked.
You're not Aelana,
Mirtai said.
I'm not pretending to be. I'm stating a legal fact. Sarabian, isn't that the way it works? Isn't my mother's power mine while she's away?
Well, technically, I suppose.
Technically, my foot. I'm Queen Aelana's heir. I'm assuming her position until she returns. That means that I temporarily own everything that's hers. Her throne, her crown, her jewels, and her personal slave.
I'd hate to have to argue against her in a court of law,
M'Ban admitted.
Thank you, Your Grace, Danae said. All right, Aitana Mirtai, you heard them. You're my property now.
Mirtai scowled at her.
Don't do that, Danae snapped. Pay attention. I am your owner, and I forbid you to kill yourself. I also forbid you to run off. I need you here. You're going to stay here with Melodir and me, and you're going to guard us. You failed my mother. Don't fail me.
Mirtai stiffened, and then she broke her chains with an angry wrench of her arms.
It shall be as you say, Majesty, she snapped, her eyes blazing.
Danae looked around at the rest of them with a smug little smile.
See, she said. Now that wasn't so hard, was it?
Chapter 4. It was a small, single-masted coastal freighter with a leaky bottom and patched sails. It definitely did not skim the waves. Barret and Khalad wore their mail shirts and traveler's cloaks, and they stood in the bow looking out across the leaden expanse of the Gulf of Mycy as the wretched vessel wallowed along.
Is that the coast up ahead?
Barret asked hopefully. Khalad looked out across the choppy water.
No, just a cloud bank. We're not moving very fast, my lord. We won't make the coast today, I'm afraid.
He looked aft and lowered his voice.
Stay alert after the sun goes down, he instructed. The crew of this tub is made up of waterfront sweepings, and the captain isn't much better. I think we should take turns sleeping tonight.
Barret glanced back along the deck at the assortment of ruffians loitering on deck.
I wish I had my axe, he muttered.
Don't say things like that out loud, Barret, Khalad muttered. Sparhawk doesn't use a war axe. Krager knows that, and one of these sailors may be working for him.
Still, after the harvest festival?
Nobody's ever figured out a way to kill all the rats, my lord, and it only takes one. Let's both behave as if we're being watched, and every word we say is being overheard, just to be on the safe side.
I'll be a lot happier once we get ashore. Did we really have to make this leg of the trip by sea?
It's the custom, Khalad shrugged. Don't worry. We can hold off these sailors if we have to.
That's not what's bothering me, Khalad. This scow waddles through the water like a whale with a sprained back. It's making me queasy.
Eat a piece of dry bread.
I'd rather not. This is really miserable, Khalad.
But we're having an adventure, my lord, Khalad said brightly. Doesn't the excitement make up for the discomfort?
No, not really.
You're the one who wanted to be a knight.
Yes, I know. And right now I'm trying to remember why.
Patriarch M'Ban was very displeased.
"This is really outrageous, Vanyan," he protested, as he waddled along with the others toward the chapel in the west wing. "If Dolmont ever finds out that I've permitted the practice of witchcraft in a consecrated place of worship, he'll have me defrocked."
"It's the safest place, Emban," Vanyan replied. "The pretense of sacred rites gives us an excuse to chase all the Tamils out of the west wing. Besides, the chapel's probably never really been consecrated anyway. This is an imitation castle built to make Aline's feel at home. The people who built it couldn't have known the rite of consecration."
"You don't know that it hasn't been consecrated?"
"And you don't know that it has. If it bothers you all that much, Emban, you can reconsecrate it after we finish."
Emban's face blanched. "Do you know what's involved in that, Vanyan?" he protested. "The hours of praying, the prostration before the altar, the fasting?"
His chubby face went pale.
"Good God, the fasting!"
Sophrenia, Flute, and Zanisha had slipped into the chapel several hours earlier, and they were sitting unobtrusively in one corner, listening to a choir of church knights singing hymns. Emban and Vanyan were still arguing when they joined the ladies.
"What's the problem?" Sophrenia asked.
"Patriarch Emban and Lord Vanyan are having a disagreement about whether or not the chapel's been consecrated, little mother," Colton explained.
"It hasn't," Flute told him with a little shrug.
"How can you tell?"
Emban demanded. She gave him a long-suffering look.
"Who am I, Your Grace?"
she asked him.
He blinked. "Oh, I keep forgetting that for some reason. Is there actually a way you can tell whether or not a place has been consecrated?"
"Well, of course there is. Believe me, Emban, this chapel's never been consecrated to your Aline God."
She paused.
"There was a spot not far from here that was consecrated to a tree about 18,000 years ago, though."
"A tree?"
"It was a very nice tree, an oak. It's always an oak for some reason. Nobody ever seems to want to worship an elm. Lots of people used to worship trees. They're predictable, for one thing."
"How could anybody in his right mind worship a tree?"
"Whoever said that religious people were in their right minds? Sometimes you humans confuse us a great deal, you know."
Since there was an exchange of features involved in most cases here, Sophrenia and Zanisha had experimented a bit to alter the spell that had imprinted Sparhawk's face on Barrett. No exchange was necessary for Sparhawk, however, so they modified him first. He sat beside his old friend, Sir Endrick, a veteran with whom he, Colton, and Martell had endured their novitiates. Zanisha approached them with the color draining from her features and that soft radiance suffusing her face. She examined Endrick meticulously, and then her voice rose as she began to intone the Delphaic spell in her oddly accented archaic Tamil. Sophrenia stood at her side, simultaneously casting the Styric spell. Sparhawk felt nothing whatsoever as Zanisha released her spell. Then, at the crucial instant, Sophrenia extended her hand, interposing it between Sir Endrick's face and Zanisha's, and simultaneously releasing the Styric spell. Sparhawk definitely felt that. His features seemed to somehow soften like melting wax, and he could actually feel his face changing, almost as wet clay is changed and molded by the potter's hand. The straightening of his broken nose was a bit painful, and the lengthening of his jaw made his teeth ache as they shifted in the bone.
"What do you think?" Sophrenia asked Vanyan when the process had been completed.
"I don't think you could get them any closer," Vanyan replied, examining the two men closely. "How does it feel to be twins, Endrick?"
"I didn't feel a thing, my lord," Endrick replied, staring curiously at Sparhawk.
"I did," Sparhawk told him, gingerly touching his reshaped nose. "Does the ache go away eventually, Anaray?" he asked.
"Thou wilt notice it less as time doth accustom thee to the alteration, Annika. I did warn thee that some discomfort is involved, did I not?"
"You did indeed," Sparhawk shrugged. "It's not unbearable."
"Do I really look like that?" Endrick asked.
"Yes,"
Vanyan replied.
"I should take better care of myself. The years aren't being good to me."
"Nobody stays young and beautiful forever, Endrick."
Colton laughed.
"Is that all that needs to be done to these two, Anaray?"
Vanyan asked.
The process is complete, Lord Vanyan,
Zanisha replied.
We need to talk, Sparhawk, the preceptor said. Let's go into the vestry where we'll be out of the way while the ladies modify the others.
Sparhawk nodded, stood up, and followed his friend to the small door to the left of the altar. Vanyan led the way inside and closed the door behind them.
You've made all the arrangements with Sorgai?
He asked. Sparhawk sat down.
I talked with him yesterday, he replied. I told him that I had some friends that had to go to Baressa without attracting attention. He's had the usual desertions, so he's holding 3 berths open. Stragan, Talon, and I'll merge with the crew. We should be able to slip into Baressa without being noticed.
I imagine that cost you. Sorgai's prices are a little steep sometimes.
Sparhawk massaged the side of his aching jaw.
It wasn't all that bad, he said. Sorgai owes me a couple of favors, and I gave him time to pick up a cargo to cover most of the cost.
You'll be going directly to the harbor from here?
Sparhawk nodded.
We'll use that tunnel Kaalador found under the barracks. I told Sorgai that his 3 new crew members would report to him about midnight.
You'll sail tomorrow, then?
Sparhawk shook his head.
The day after. We have to load Sorgai's cargo tomorrow.
Honest work, Sparhawk?
Vanyan smiled.
You're starting to sound like Halad.
He does have opinions, doesn't he?
So did his father.
Quit rubbing your face like that, Sparhawk. You'll make your skin raw.
Vanyan paused.
What was it like?
Very strange.
Painful?
The nose was. It feels almost as if somebody broke it again. Be glad you don't have to go through it.
There wouldn't be much point in that. I won't be sneaking down alleys the way the rest of you will.
Vanyan looked sympathetically at his friend.
We'll get her back, Sparhawk, he said.
Of course. Was that all?
Sparhawk's tone was deliberately unemotional. The important thing here was not to feel.
Just be careful and try to keep a handle on your temper.
Sparhawk nodded.
Let's go see how the others are coming.
The alterations were confusing. There was no question about that. It was hard to tell exactly who was talking, and sometimes Sparhawk was startled by just who answered his questions. They said their goodbyes and quietly left the chapel with the main body of the church knights. They went out into the torchlit courtyard, crossed the drawbridge, and proceeded across the night-shrouded lawn to the barracks of the knights, where Sparhawk, Stragan, and Talon changed into tar-smeared sailor smocks, while the others also donned the mismatched clothing of commoners. Then they all went down to the cellar. Kaalador, who now wore the blocky face of a middle-aged Deiran knight, led the way into a damp, cobweb-draped tunnel with a smoky torch. When he had gone about a mile, he stopped and raised the torch.
"This year's your exit, Sparhawk,"
he said, pointing at a steep, narrow stairway. "You'll come out in an alley.
Which it is don't smell none too sweet, but it's good and dark."
He paused. "Sorry, Stragan," he apologized. "I wanted to give you something to remember me by."
You're too kind, Stragan murmured.
Good luck, Sparhawk,
Kaalador said then.
Thanks, Kaalador.
The two shook hands, and then Kaalador lifted his torch and led the rest of the party down the musty-smelling passageway toward their assorted destinations, leaving Sparhawk, Talon, and Stragan alone in the dark.
They won't be in any danger, Vanyan,
Flute assured the preceptor as the ladies were packing.
I'll be going along after all. And I can take care of them.
10 nights, then.
He amended his suggestion downward.
They'd just be in our way, love,
Sophronia told him.
I do want you to be careful, though. A body of armed men is far more likely to be attacked than a small party of travelers.
But it isn't safe for ladies to travel alone, he protested. There are always robbers and the like lurking in the forest.
We won't be in one place long enough to attract robbers or anybody else. Flute told him. We'll be in Delphaeus in 2 days. I could do it in 1, but I'll have to stop and have a long talk with Eudamus before I go into his valley. He might just take a bit of convincing. When art thou leaving Mithurion, Lord Vanyan?
Zanisha asked.
"About the end of the week, Anaray," he replied. "We've got to spend some time on our equipment, and there's always the business of organizing the supply train."
"Take warm clothing," Sophronia instructed. "The weather could change at any time."
"Yes, love. How long will you be at Delphaeus?"
"We can't be sure. Afriel will keep you advised. We have a great deal to discuss with Anarai Sedan. The fact that Sirgon has summoned Clell complicates matters." "Truly," Zenisha agreed, "we may be obliged to entreat Edamus to return."
"Would he do that?"
Flute smiled roguishly.
"I'll coax him, Banyan," she said, "and you know how good I am at that. If I really want something, I almost always get it."
"You there! Look lively!" Sorgai's bull-necked bosun bellowed, popping his whip at Stragan's heels.
Stragan, who now wore the braids and sweeping mustaches of a blonde Genidian knight, dropped the bale he was carrying across the deck and reached for his dagger.
"No!" Sparhawk elbowed him. "Pick up that bale."
Stragan glared at him for a moment, then bent and lifted the bale again.
"This wasn't part of the agreement," he muttered.
"He's not really going to hit you with that whip," Talon assured the fuming Salesian. "Sailors all complain about it, but the whip's just for show. A bosun who really hits his men with his whip usually gets thrown over the side some night during the voyage."
"Maybe," Stragan growled darkly. "But I'll tell you this right now. If that cretin so much as touches me with that whip of his, he won't live long enough to go swimming. I'll have his guts in a pile on the deck before he can even blink."
"You new men," the bosun shouted, "do your talking on your own time. You're here to work, not to discuss the weather."
And he cracked his whip again.
"She could do it, Khalad," Barrett insisted.
"I think you've been out in the sun too long," Khalad replied.
They were riding south along a lonely beach under an overcast sky. The beach was backed by an uninviting salt marsh where dry reeds clattered against each other in the stiff onshore breeze. Khalad rose in his stirrups and looked around. Then he settled back in his saddle again.
"It's a ridiculous idea, my lord."
"Try to keep an open mind, Khalad. Afriel's a goddess. She can do anything."
"I'm sure she can. But why would she want to?"
"Well..." Barrett struggled with it. "She could have a reason, couldn't she? Something that you and I wouldn't even understand?"
"Is this what all that steric training does to a man? You're starting to see gods under every bush. It was only a coincidence. The two of them look a little bit alike, but that's all."
"You can be as skeptical as you want, Khalad, but I still think that something very strange is going on."
"And I think that what you're suggesting is an absurdity."
"Absurd or not, their mannerisms are the same. Their expressions are identical, and they've both got that same air of smug superiority about them."
"Of course they do. Afriel's a goddess, and Danae's a crown princess. They are superior, at least in their own minds. And I think you're overlooking the fact that we saw them both in the same room and at the same time. They even talked to each other, for God's sake."
"Khalad, that doesn't mean anything. Afriel's a goddess. She can probably be in a dozen different places all at the same time if she really wants to be."
"That still brings us right back to the question of why. What would be the purpose of it? Not even a god does things without any reason."
"We don't know that, Khalad. Maybe she's doing it just to amuse herself."
"Are you really all that desperate to witness miracles, Barrett?"
"She could do it," Barrett insisted.
"All right. So what?"
"Aren't you the least bit curious about it?"
"Not particularly."
Khalad shrugged. Ulath and Tinian wore bits and pieces of the uniforms of one of the few units of the Tamil army that accepted volunteers from the Aline kingdoms of western Deresia. The faces they had borrowed were those of grizzled, middle-aged knights, the faces of hard-bitten veterans. The vessel aboard which they sailed was one of those battered, ill-maintained ships that ply coastal waters. The small amount of money they had paid for their passage bought them exactly that. Passage, and nothing else. They had brought their own food and drink, and their patched blankets,
and they ate and slept on the deck. Their destination was a small coastal village some 25 leagues east of the foothills of the Tommel Mountains. They lounged on the deck in the daytime, drinking cheap wine and rolling dice for pennies. The sky was overcast when the ship's longboat deposited them on the rickety wharf of the village. The day was cool, and the Tommel Mountains were little more than a low smudge on the horizon.
"What was that horse trader's name again?" Tinian asked.
"Sableless,"
Ulaf grunted.
"I hope Oscania was right," Tinian said. "If this Sableless has gone out of business, we'll have to walk to those mountains."
Ulaf stepped across the wharf to speak to a pinch-faced fellow who was mending a fishnet.
"Tell me, friend," he said politely in Tommel, "where can we find Sableless the horse trader?"
"What if I don't feel like telling you?" the scrawny netmender replied in a whining nasal voice that identified him as one of those mean-spirited men who would rather die than be helpful, or even polite.
Tinian had encountered his kind before. Small men, usually, with an inflated notion of their own worth. Men who delighted in irritating others just for the fun of it.
"Let me," he murmured, laying one gently restraining hand on his Thalesian companion's arm.
Ulaf's bunched muscles clearly spoke of impending violence.
"Nice net," Tinian noted casually, picking up one edge of it. Then he drew his dagger and began cutting the strings.
"What are you doing?"
the pinch-faced fisherman screamed.
"I'm showing you what," Tinian explained. "You said, what if I don't feel like telling you? This is what. Think it over. My friend and I aren't in any hurry, so take your time."
He took a fistful of net and sawed through it with his knife.
"Stop!"
the fellow shrieked in horror.
"Ah! Where was it you said we might find Sableless?"
Ulaf asked innocently.
"His corrals are on the eastern edge of town."
The words came tumbling out. Then the scrawny fellow gathered up his net in both arms and held it to his chest, almost like a mother shielding a child from harm.
"Have a pleasant day, neighbor," Tinian said, sheathing his dagger. "I can't begin to tell you how much we've appreciated your help."
And the two knights turned and walked along the wharf toward the shabby-looking village. Their camp was neat and orderly, with a place for everything, and everything exactly where it belonged. Barrett had noticed that Halad always set up camp in exactly the same way. He seemed to have some concept of the ideal camp etched in his mind, and since it was perfect, he never altered it. Halad was very rigid in some ways. "How far did we come today?" Barrett asked, as they washed up their supper dishes.
10 leagues,
Halad shrugged.
"The same as always. 10 leagues is standard on level terrain."
"This is going to take forever," Barrett complained.
"No, it might seem like it, though."
Halad looked around and then lowered his voice until it was hardly more than a whisper.
"We're not really in any hurry, Barrett," he said. "We might even want to slow down a bit."
"What?"
"Keep your voice down. Sparhawk and the others have a long way to go, and we want to be sure they're in place before Klager, or whoever it is, makes contact with us. We don't know when or where that's going to happen, so the best way to delay it is to slow down."
Halad looked out into the darkness beyond the circle of firelight.
"How good are you at magic?"
"Not very," Barrett admitted, scrubbing diligently. "I've still got a lot to learn. What did you want me to do?"
"Could you make one of our horses limp, without actually hurting him?"
Barrett probed through his memory. Then he shook his head. "I don't think I know any spells that would do that."
"That's too bad. A lame horse would give us a good reason to slow down."
It came without warning, a cold, prickling kind of sensation that seemed to be centered at the back of Barrett's neck. "That's good enough," he said in a louder voice. "I'm not getting paid enough to scrub holes in tin plates." He rinsed off the dish he'd been washing, shook most of the water off it, and stowed it back into the pack.
"You felt it too?"
Halad's whisper came out from between motionless lips. That startled Barrett. How could Halad have known? Barrett buckled the straps on the pack and gave his friend a curt nod. "Let's build up the fire a bit and then get some sleep." He said it loudly enough to be heard out beyond the circle of firelight. The two of them walked toward their pile of firewood. Barrett was murmuring the spell and concealing the movements of his hands at the same time.
Who is it?
Again, Halad's lips did not move.
I'm still working on that, Barrett whispered back.
He released the spell so slowly that it seemed almost to dribble out of the ends of his fingers. The sense of it came washing back to him. It was something on the order of recognizing an accent, except that it was done when nobody was talking.
It's a Styric, he said quietly.
Zalasta?
No, I don't believe so. I think I'd recognize him. It's somebody I've never been around before.
Not too much wood, my lord, Halad said aloud. This pile has to get us through breakfast, too, you know.
Good thinking, Barrett approved. He reached out again, very cautiously. He's moving away, he muttered. How did you know we were being watched?
I could feel it, Halad shrugged. I always know when somebody's watching me. How noisy is it when you get in touch with Afriel?
That's one of the good spells. It doesn't make a sound.
You'd better tell her about this. Let her know that we are being watched, and that it's Asteric who's doing the watching.
Halad knelt and began carefully to stack his armload of broken off limbs on their campfire.
Your disguise seems to be working, he noted.
How did you arrive at that?
They wouldn't waste Asteric on us if they knew who you really were.
Unless they don't have anybody left except Styrix. Stragan's celebration of the Harvest Festival might have been more effective than we thought.
We could probably argue about that all night. Just tell Afriel about our visitor out there. She'll pass it on to the others, and we'll let them get the headache from trying to sort it out with logic.
Aren't you curious about it?
Not so curious that I'm going to lose any sleep over it. That's one of the advantages of being a peasant, my lord. We're not required to come up with the answers to these earth-shaking questions. You aristocrats get the pleasure of doing that.
Thanks, Barrett said sourly.
No charge, my lord.
Halad grinned. Sparhawk had never actually worked for a living before, and he discovered that he did not like it very much. He quickly grew to hate Captain Sorgai's thick-necked bosun. The man was crude, stupid, and spitefully cruel. He fawned outrageously whenever Sorgai appeared on the quarterdeck, but when the captain returned below decks, the bosun's natural character reasserted itself. He seemed to take particular delight in tormenting the newest members of the crew, assigning them the most tedious, exhausting, and demeaning tasks aboard ship. Sparhawk found himself quite suddenly in full agreement with Halad's class prejudices, and sometimes at night he found himself contemplating murder.
Every man hates his employer, Fran, Stragan told him, using Sparhawk's assumed name. It's a very natural part of the scheme of things. I could stand him if he didn't deliberately go out of his way to be offensive, Sparhawk growled, scrubbing at the deck with his block of pumice stone. He's paid to be offensive, my friend. Angry men work harder. Part of your problem is that you always look him right in the eye. He wouldn't single you out the way he does if you'd keep your eyes lowered. If you don't, this is going to be a very long voyage for you.
Or a short one for him, Sparhawk said darkly. He considered it that night as he tried, without much success, to sleep in his hammock. He fervently wished that he could get his hands on the idiot who had decided that humans could sleep in hammocks. The roll of the ship made it swing from side to side, and Sparhawk continually felt that he was right on the verge of being thrown out.
Annika.
The voice was only a whisper in his mind. Sparhawk was stunned.
Blue Rose, he said.
Prithee, Annika, do not speak aloud. Thy voice is as the thunder in mine ears. Speak silently in the halls of thine awareness. I will hear thee.
How is this possible? Sparhawk framed the thought. Thou art confined.
Who hath power to confine me, Annika? When thou art alone and thy mind is clear of other distraction, we may speak thus.
I did not know that.
Until now, it was not needful for thee to know.
I see. But now it is?
Yes.
How dost thou penetrate the barrier of the gold?
It is no barrier to me, Annika. Others may not sense me within the confines of thine excellent receptacle. I, however, may reach out to thee in this manner. This is particularly true when we are so close.
Sparhawk laid his hand on the leather pouch hanging on a thong about his neck and felt the square outline of the box.
And should it prove needful, may I speak so with thee?
Even as thou dost now, Annika.
This is good to know.
I sense thy disquiet, Annika, and I share thine anxiety for the safety of thy mate.
Thou art kind to say so, Blue Rose.
Expend thou all thine efforts to securing thy queen's release, Annika. I will keep watch over our enemies whilst thou art so occupied.
The jewel under Sparhawk's hand paused.
Hear me well, my friend, Bellium continued. Should it come to pass that no other course be open to thee, fear not to surrender me up to obtain thy mate's freedom.
That I will not do, for she hath forbidden it.
Do not be untranquil if it should come to pass, Annika. I will not submit to Sirgon, even though mine own child, whom I love even as thou lovest thine, be endangered by my refusal. Be comforted in the knowledge that I will not permit my child, nor thee and all thy kind, to be enslaved by Sirgon, or, worse yet, by Clel. Thou hast my promise that this will never happen. Should it appear that our task doth verge on failure, I give thee my solemn vow that I shall destroy this child of mine and all who dwell here to prevent such mischance.
Is that supposed to make me feel better?
Chapter 5. She was always tired, hovering at times on the verge of exhaustion, and she was nearly always wet and dirty. Her clothes were ripped and tattered, and her hair was a ruin. Those things were unimportant, however. She willingly submitted to discomfort and indignities to keep the madman who was their captor from hurting the terrified Aileen. The realization that Scarpa was mad had come to her slowly. She had known from the first moment she had seen him that he was ruthless and driven, but the evidence of his insanity had become gradually more and more overwhelming as the endless days of her captivity ground on. He was cruel, but Aelana had encountered cruel men before. After she and Aileen had been hurried through the dank tunnels under the streets of Mithurin to the outskirts of the city, they had been roughly shoved into the saddles of waiting horses, bound securely in place, and literally dragged at breakneck speed down the road leading to the port of Mycie, on the southwestern coast of the peninsula, 75 leagues away. A normal man does not mistreat the animals upon which he is totally dependent. That was the first evidence of Scarpa's madness. He drove the horses, flogging them savagely until the poor beasts were staggering with exhaustion, and his only words during those dreadful 4 days were, "Faster! Faster!" Aelana shuddered as she recalled the horror of that endless ride. They had... Her horse stumbled in the muddy path, and she was jolted forward, bringing her attention back into the immediate present. The cord that tightly bound her wrists to the saddle bow dug into her flesh, and the bleeding started again. She tried to ease into a different position so that the cord would no longer cut into the already open wounds.
"What are you doing?"
Scarpa demanded. His voice was harsh, and it came out almost as a scream. Scarpa almost always screamed when he was talking to her.
"I'm just trying to keep the cord from cutting deeper into my wrists, Lord Scarpa," she replied meekly.
She had been instructed early in her captivity to address himself, and she had quickly found that failure to do so resulted in savage mistreatment of Aileen and the withholding of food and water.
"You're not here to be comfortable, woman," he raged at her. "You're here to obey.
I see what you're doing there. If you don't stop trying to loosen those cords, I'll use wire."
His eyes bulged, and she saw again that strange bluish cast to the whites of those eyes and the abnormally large pupils.
"Yes, Lord Scarpa," she said in her most submissive tone.
He glared at her, his face filled with suspicion, and his mad eyes looking hungrily for some excuse to punish or humiliate his prisoners further. She lowered her gaze to stare fixedly at the rough, muddy track that wound deeper and deeper into the rank, vine-choked forest of the southeast coast of Darisia. The ship they had boarded at the port of Mycy had been a sleek, black-hulled corsair that could not have been built for any honest purpose. She and Aileen had been unceremoniously dragged below decks and confined in a cramped compartment that smelled of the bilges and was totally dark. After they had been 2 hours at sea, the compartment door had opened, and Craeger had entered with two swarthy sailors, one carrying what appeared to be a decent meal, and the other two pails of hot water, some soap, and a wad of rags for use as towels. Aylana had resisted an impulse to embrace the fellow.
"I'm really sorry about all this, Aylana,"
Craeger had apologized, squinting at her nearsightedly.
"But I have no control of the situation. Be very careful of what you say to Scarpa. You've probably noticed that he's not entirely rational."
He had looked around nervously, then laid a handful of cheap tallow candles on the rough table and left, chaining the door shut behind him. They had been 5 days at sea, and had reached Annan, a port city on the edge of the jungles of the southeast coast, sometime after midnight. Then she and Aileen had been hustled into a closed carriage with a pouchy-eyed Baron Perak at the reins. During the transfer from the ship to the carriage, Aylana had discreetly looked at each of her captors, seeking some weakness. Craeger, despite his habitual drunkenness, was too shrewd, and Perak was Scarpa's longtime confederate, a man evidently untroubled by his friend's madness. Then she had coolly appraised Elrond. She had noticed that under no circumstances would the foppish Astellian poet look her in the eye. His apparent murder of Melodir had evidently filled him with remorse. Elrond was a poseur, rather than a man of action, and he clearly had no stomach for blood. She had recalled, moreover, how vain he had been about his long curls when she had first met him, and had wondered what form of duress Scarpa had used to force him to shave his head in order to pose as one of Kring's Poloi. She had surmised that the violation of his hair had raised certain strong resentments in him. Elrond was clearly reluctant to participate in this affair, and that made him the weak link. She kept that fact firmly in mind now. The time might come when she could use it to her advantage. The carriage had carried them from the waterfront to a large house on the outskirts of Annan. It had been there that Scarpa had spoken with a gaunt Styrek with the lumpy features characteristic of the men of his race. The Styrek's name was Keska, and his eyes had the look of one hopelessly damned.
"I don't care about the discomfort," Scarpa had half-shouted to the gaunt man at one point. "Time is important, Keska. Time! Just do it. As long as it doesn't kill us, we can endure it."
The next morning the significance of that command had become all too obvious. Keska was evidently one of those outcast Styrek magicians, but not a very good one. He could, with a great deal of clearly exhausting effort, compress the miles that lay between them and Scarpa's intended destination, but only a few miles each time, and the compression was accompanied by a horrid kind of wrenching agony. It seemed almost as if the clumsy magician were jerking them up and hurling them blindly forward with every ounce of his strength, and Aylana could never be certain after each hideous, bruising jump that she was still intact. She felt torn and battered, but did what she could to conceal her pain from Aileen. The gentle girl with the large eyes wept almost continuously now, overcome by her pain and fear and the misery of their circumstances. Aylana drew her mind into the present and looked about warily. It was approaching evening again. The overcast sky was gradually darkening, and the time of day Aylana dreaded the most would soon be upon them. Scarpa looked with some scorn at Keska, who slumped in his saddle like a wilted flower, obviously near exhaustion.
"This is far enough," he said. "Set up some kind of camp and get the women down off those horses."
His brittle eyes grew bright as he looked Aylana full in the face.
"It's time for the bedraggled Queen of the Alenes to beg for her supper again. I do hope she'll be more convincing this time. It really distresses me to have to refuse her when her pleas aren't sufficiently sincere."
Elana,
Tager whispered, touching her shoulder. The fire had died down to embers, and Elana could hear the sound of snores coming from the other side of their rude camp.
What?
She replied shortly.
Keep your voice down.
He was still wearing the black leather polloi jerkin. His shaved head was sparsely stubbled, and his wine-reeking breath was nearly overpowering.
I'm doing you a favor. Don't put me in danger. I assume you realize by now that Scarpa's completely insane. Really, she replied sardonically, what an amazing thing. Please don't make this any more difficult. I seem to have made a small error in judgment here. If I'd fully realized how deranged that half-styric bastard is, I'd have never agreed to take part in this ridiculous adventure. What is this strange fascination you have with lunatics, Krager?
He shrugged.
Maybe it's a character defect. Scarpa actually believes that he can outwit his father, and even Sirgon. He doesn't really believe that Sparhawk will surrender Bellium in exchange for your return, and he's managed to about half convince the others. I'm sure you realize by now how he feels about women.
He's demonstrated it often enough, she said bitterly. Does he share Baron Harperin's fondness for little boys instead?
Scarpa isn't fond of anything except himself. He is his only passion. I've seen him spend hours trimming that beard of his. It gives him the opportunity to adore his reflection in the mirror. You haven't seen his delightful personality in full flower. The details of this trip are keeping what he chooses to call his mind occupied. Wait until we get to Natayos and you hear him start raving. He makes Martell and Anias seem like the very souls of sanity by comparison. I don't dare stay too long, so listen closely. Scarpa believes that Sparhawk will bring Bellium with him when he comes. Right enough. But he doesn't believe he'll bring it to trade for you. Scarpa's absolutely certain that your husband's coming in order to have it out with Sirgon, and he believes that they'll destroy each other in the course of the argument. Sparhawk has Bellium, you fool, and Bellium eats gods for breakfast. I'm not here to argue about that. Maybe Sparhawk will win, and maybe he won't. That's really beside the point. What's important to us is what Scarpa believes. He's convinced himself that Sparhawk and Sirgon will fight a war of mutual extinction. Then he thinks that Bellium will be left lying around free for the taking. What about Zalasta? I get the strong feeling that Scarpa doesn't expect Zalasta to be around when the fight's over. Scarpa's more than willing to kill anybody who gets in his way.
He'd kill his own father? Krager shrugged.
Blood ties don't mean anything to Scarpa. When he was younger, he decided that his mother and his half-sisters knew things about him that he didn't want them to share with the authorities, so he killed them. He hated them anyway, so that may not mean all that much. If Sparhawk and Sirgon do kill each other, and if Zalasta's broken out in a sudden rash of mortality during the festivities, Scarpa might just be the only one left around to take possession of the Bellium. He's got an army in these jungles, and if he has the Bellium as well, he might be able to pull it off. He'll march on Mathirion, take the city, and slaughter the government. Then he'll crown himself emperor. I'm personally betting against it, though. So for God's sake, keep your temper under control. You're not really important to his plans, but you're vital to Zalasta's, and mine. If you do anything at all to set Scarpa off, he'll kill you as quickly as he ordered Elrond to kill your lady-in-waiting. Zalasta and I believe that Sparhawk will trade Bellium for you, but only if you're alive. Don't enrage that maniac. If he kills you, all our plans will collapse.
Why are you telling me this, Krager? There's something else, too, isn't there?
Of course. If things go against us, I'd like to have you available to speak out in my behalf when the trials start.
That wouldn't do any good, I'm afraid, she told him sweetly. There won't be any trial for you, Krager. Sparhawk's already given you to Halad, and Halad's already made up his mind.
Halad?
Prager's voice sounded a little weak.
Kirik's oldest son. He seems to feel that you had some part in his father's death, and he feels obliged to do something about it. I suppose you could try to talk him out of it, but I'd advise you to talk fast if you do. Khalad's an abrupt young man, and he'll probably have you hanging from a meat hook before you can get out three words.
Krager didn't answer, but slipped away instead, his shaved scalp pale in the darkness. It wasn't much of a victory, Elana privately conceded, but in her situation, victories of any kind were very hard to come by.
They actually do that?
Scarpa's harsh voice was hungry.
It's an old custom, Lord Scarpa, Elana replied in a meek voice, keeping her eyes downcast as they plodded along the muddy path. Emperor Sarabian is planning to discontinue the practice, however.
It will be reinstituted immediately following my coronation.
Scarpa's eyes were very bright.
It is a proper form of respect.
Scarpa had an old purple velvet cloak, shiny with wear, that he had dramatically pulled over one shoulder in a grotesque imitation of an imperial mantle, and he struck absurd poses with each pronouncement.
As you say, Lord Scarpa, it was tedious to go over the same things again and again, but it kept Scarpa's mind occupied,
and when his attention was firmly fixed on the ceremonies and practices of the imperial court in Mithyrian, he was not thinking of ways to make life unbearable for his captives.
"Describe it again," he commanded. "I'll need to know precisely how it's supposed to be done, so that I can punish those who fail to perform it properly."
Elana sighed. "At the approach of the imperial person, the members of the court kneel."
"On both knees?"
"Yes, Lord Scarpa."
"Excellent! Excellent!"
His face was exalted.
"Go on."
"Then, as the emperor passes, they lean forward, put the palms of their hands on the floor, and touch their foreheads to the tiles."
"Capital!"
He suddenly giggled, a high-pitched, almost girlish sound that startled her. She gave him a quick, sidelong glance. His face was grotesquely distorted into an expression of unholy exaltation. And then his eyes grew wide, and his expression became one of near religious ecstasy.
"And the Tamils who rule the world shall be ruled by me," he intoned in a resonant, declamatory voice. "All power shall be mine. The governance of the world shall be in my hands, and disobedience will be death."
Elana shuddered as he raved on. And he came to her again as humid night settled over their muddy forest encampment, drawn to her by a hunger, a greed that was beyond his ability to control. It was revolting, but Elana realized that her knowledge of the particulars of traditional court ceremonies gave her an enormous power over him. His hunger was insatiable, and only she could satisfy it. She grasped that power firmly, drawing strength and confidence from it, actually relishing it, even as Krager and the others withdrew with expressions of frightening revulsion.
"Nine wives, you say?" Scarpa's voice was almost pleading. "Why not 90? Why not 900?
"It is the custom, Lord Scarpa. The reason for it should be obvious."
"Oh, of course, of course."
He brooded darkly over it.
"I shall have 9,000, he proclaimed, "and each shall be more desirable than the last. And when I have finished with them, they shall be given to my loyal soldiers. Let no woman dare to believe that my favor in any way empowers her. All women are only whores. I shall buy them and throw them away when I tire of them."
End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.